Well, why don't we start with some questions from yesterday? From yesterday. Do you have any questions about yesterday's lecture? I hope so. Any unresolved mysteries? Well, I must have been getting clearer. So at the end of the last lecture, we ended up with a statement. The statement was that the amplitude at string theory would associate to some process or some topology. In space-time. Should be written at least in a moral sense as a sequence of true operations. The first operation will be a path integral over the coordinates that tell you how the string is embedded in space-time. This path integral is an action. It describes a quantum field theory that lives on sigma, on the worksheet. A quantum field theory of a bunch of scalar fields which tell you where sigma is in space-time. We wrote this action with some metric. On the worksheet. And I said, after we do this path integral, which is, you know, nice Gaussian free path integral with a non-trivial metric on the surface, we should integrate over the space, subspace of representatives of classes of metrics. We call this space mu sigma, some space of metrics on sigma, modulo diffeomorphisms and wild transformations. This almost is going to be true, not just in the moral sense, actually in a true sense, although we need to introduce some ghosts to deal properly with the gauge fixing of diffeomorphism and wild gauge symmetry. So this question is pretty much correct, except for some ghosts. Contributions which we'll discuss in appropriate time. So now I would like to give you an idea of how this space looks like. What is this space of metrics, modulo, diffeomorphisms, and wild that we want to integrate over? So let's look locally on this surface sigma. Sigma will be built up of a bunch of patches which close in a non-trivial topological way. In each local patch, there are theorems of classical geometry which tell you that you can use a diffeomorphism to put the metric in a diagonal form as a multiple, to bring it to be a multiple of the identity. So in each patch, you can do this operation. Pick a coordinate system where the metric is diagonal. And in each patch, you have a different coordinate system a priori. So what you can ask is, how do coordinate transformations between patches look like? These coordinate transformations must be somewhat special because they must take a metric which is proportional to the identity and map it to another metric which is proportional to the identity. So these are called conformal transformations. You probably encountered them in the previous course. In two dimensions, conformal transformations are very nice and special. They are expressed most easily if you combine your coordinates in some complex coordinate. Then the coordinate transformations are simply holomorphic. Meaning the condition for a coordinate transformation to be conformal is simply the del over del z bar of z prime is 0. So you can take this picture and sort of forget about everything except for the complex coordinates and their holomorphic coordinate transformations. So this structure, the reporter of sigma, essentially becomes equipped sigma with a structure of a one-dimensional complex manifold. Which is also something called the Riemann surface. So, I mean, a complex manifold is essentially by definition a manifold with a property that you can pick all of complex coordinates and in each patch, and coordinate transformations are holomorphic.
And the non-trivial topology, where is going to be coded? In the transformations or?
In the global, in everything. So the collection of patches together with their transformations define, give you the global topology of the manifold together with its complex structure. Okay. Let me see if we can give some useful examples. Well, of course, the simplest complex manifold is the plane. Which is identified the complex plane. Another slightly more interesting complex manifold is the cylinder. If you want to think about it as a complex manifold, you can sort of take a complex coordinate, call it sigma, which is let me call it S sigma. So let me call it S, which is sigma plus I tau, where sigma runs this way and tau runs this way. And then you could say, so the sin as a real manifold, this is defined by saying that sigma goes to sigma as identified with sigma plus 2 pi r. As a complex manifold, is defined by saying that S is identified with S plus 2 pi r. Okay, still pretty boring. More complicated, a slightly more complicated complex manifold could be the torus. Not very good at drawing tori, clearly. So a way to define a torus is to take the complex plane. And I mean, to define a torus as a real manifold, you take the plane and you will identify it under two different translations. As a complex manifold, you will say that your coordinate on the torus, the local coordinate z, is identified under z goes to z plus 2 pi, and under z goes to z plus 2 pi tau, where tau is some complex number. This could be a way to define the torus as a complex manifold. See, everything is holomorphic. Now, it turns out that this is actually that all tori, all complex manifolds which look like a torus, can be given a coordinate system which looks like this. Now, this is sort of an over-complete parametrization. You can have tori defined by different values of tau, which are the same complex manifold, which are related by some complex coordinate transformation. In particular, the mod transformation that sends tau to a tau plus b over c tau plus d, where a, b, c, d are integers, and a d minus b c equal to 1 are known to map this torus back to another complex torus. Are identifications on the spaces of complex structures of the torus. Meaning if you do this transformation, you can also find the coordinate transformation from some z to some z prime, such that z prime is still periodic with these sort of integral shifts, but with periodicity, which is this. Okay. This new coordinate is some multiple of z prime, just some rescaling and rotation, which are conformal transformations. And so on and so forth. You can describe. So in general, the sort of complex manifolds that we need in theory, right? Are some surfaces, you know, with a bunch of semi-infinite cubes and a bunch of loops.
Are we only considering manifolds that are infinitely differentiable?
Holomorphic coordinate transformations are infinitely differentiable. I mean, they have a bit more structure than the main thing.
But the manifolds of like the Schwarzschild
so yeah, we are considering complex manifolds.
Mm-hmm. Can you still parameterize your space of metrics with like complex structures if you take your metrics to have like Lorentzian signature instead?
My guess, but I'm not 100% sure, is that you can parametrize them by sort of analytically continued complex structures. What do I mean? So in this Euclidean signature, I have z prime is a function of z, and the complex conjugate, of course, is the complex conjugate function of the complex conjugate variable. So if you want this z bar is defined as the complex conjugate of z, z bar prime is defined as the complex conjugate of z prime. in Lorentzian signature, you would define coordinates like what U1 plus U2 and U1 minus U2 and conformal transformations would just map, let me call this U plus, Z plus and Z minus. It will be, you know, map Z plus to a function of Z plus and Z minus to an independent function of Z minus. So instead of having one complex function, you could have two real functions. Now, all of this sort of sits inside a bigger space, so you just take two independent complex transformations. You trace Z and Z bar sort of the independent complex variables. So my suspicion is that you can think about surfaces as Lorentzian signature as living somewhere in the in a further complexification of this moduli space. I'm not 100% sure, but at least in a moral sense, the space of Lorentzian surfaces is sort of some middle dimensional cycle in the probable space of complex structures and its complex conjugate. Or anyway, so by complexifying further the complex, okay. Sorry. So on this space of complex structures that I wanted to give a name to. Okay. So suppose if your surface has n outside legs and g loops, then the space of complex structure I call m g comma n. It's a very interesting and complicated space. It's a complex manifold, actually, which still has some local coordinates as well, which are complex. Now, I think that Lorentzian conformal, the Lorentzian surfaces probably sit somewhere in MGN times MGN bar, where I use the transformations of Z plus to define an auxiliary complex manifold and the transformations of Z minus to define an auxiliary anti-homomorphic, well, again, complex manifold, but complex conjugate. So the usual Euclidean surfaces live in the place where this point is complex conjugate to this point. And Lorentzian signatures would, the Lorentzian surfaces would live somewhere else. So when you have an integral like this on a complex manifold, you can sort of think about it as an integral over a locus inside here, where the coordinate equals to the conjugate of the bar coordinate. Once you think about this as a contour integral, it can be deformed away from that locus. It's actually very useful even for very basic integrals on the complex plane. And so you can sort of reach Lorentzian signatures by analytical continuation from Euclidean signatures. Well, I'll give you an example of a sort of games, rather concrete, in a few lectures. So I'm sorry, it probably looks quite mysterious now, but hopefully it will be less mysterious. Now, what I wanted to do was to write down a list of manifolds and a corresponding of surfaces and at least sketch how the moduli space of complex structures would look like. So So the simplest physical process you can think of is a string decaying into sorry, I mean, these blackboards are not very tall and they're very long, so let me just turn the picture on. So I'm going to write a surface and the corresponding moduli space. So the simplest physical process could be a string that breaks into two strings, a decay process of some sort. This space, the moduli space of complex structures for this, so this has zero loops and three external legs. This actually has a unique complex structure. So it turns out that no matter what metric do you put on this, you can always make it locally locally diagonal, and there are no moduli left. So all the metrics that you can put on this object can be related by a Weyl transformation. And you know, now this is analogous to the statement that in quantum field theory, this Feynman diagram has no internal legs, has no Schwinger parameters. Remember that this integral over the space of matrix is supposed to be completely analogous to the integral over Schwinger parameters in quantum field theory. So it's not unreasonable that something with three external legs would have no moduli. The next diagram has four external legs. The corresponding space of complex structures is one-dimensional. So essentially, you fix all your freedom in getting the metric around the three of the legs fixed. And then the metric around the fourth leg has an extra degree of freedom. So the space of complex structures, which is M04, turns out to look like this. So it's one-dimensional complex manifold. It has sort of three long regions. In this region, you can write a representative metric for your Riemann surface. Which looks like these. In this region, you can write a representative metric on your Riemann surface, which looks like these.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. We're trying to.
I'm giving you some facts. I'm not proving them to you. We'll learn how to prove these facts later. I'm just giving you, for informational purposes, how would these moduli spaces roughly look like?
But what does it mean that, like, it's still under some diagram? It seems like for one of the legs you draw that kind of, I don't know.
So this is a space of Riemann surface, of matrix, modulo Weyl, and diffeomorphism. So for every point in this space, I should be able to give you an actual metric.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm giving you a representative for this metric.
Why does it have four legs?
So this is sigma.
Okay.
And I'm saying near this region, in this region of the moduli space, sigma has a very long intermediate tube.
Okay.
So there is some tube whose length is very big compared to the transversal size.
Okay.
Question?
I'm not following
it. I want to describe the moduli space of matrix
Do you have a complex manifold?
Yeah, I have this topology. Okay.
Yes.
So I want to put a metric on this.
String scattering.
Yes. I want to put a metric on it.
Okay.
I claim there is a one-dimensional, one complex dimensional space of metrics I can put on this.
Okay.
Modulo wild transformations. Okay? So when I compute my string amplitude, I have to integrate over this moduli space.
What are you requiring from your metric that you can restrict it so much?
No, it's a metric here. It's a metric here. Which has,
so
well, I'm requiring that it has some semi-infinite tubes, four semi-infinite tubes, and looks like a sphere. Looks like a, has no loops.
Okay.
Yes?
But these like three channels.
I get there, yes.
But those are requirements on your manifold, not on the metric, right? The metric is just some tensor on your manifold?
Yes.
With what requirements? Like it needs to be symmetric, for example.
Yes. So take this manifold, put on it some symmetric tensor.
Yeah. And you're claiming that there's only one parameter, like a one parameter space.
That modulo wave transformations, there is only one parameter space of metrics. Then no matter what wiggles and bumps you put in your metric, you can smoothen them out using a wild transformation. See, you can think about it this way. So in two-dimensional, the metric does two things. It tells you something about distances, and it tells you something about angles. While transformations tell you, forget about distances, only angles matter. And I'm telling you that if your purpose is to just put information about angles on a surface, you get a one parameter space of choices. And I'm trying to describe these choices. This parameter space looks like this blob with three asymptotic regions.
That parameter space looks like a blob?
Yes. The parameter space is one complex dimensional, and it looks like
this. So it's a region in C.
Hmm? Sorry?
So it's just a region in C.
No, it's something with three tubes, which connect smoothly together.
How do you go from a function,
There is an infinite dimensional function space,
yeah,
and there's infinite dimensional gauge symmetry.
Okay.
The difference is a finite dimensional space.
And how do you associate a manifold with that? Like how does that jump out?
Well, there is definitely a notion of two metrics being close to each other.
Well, it gets a little harder once you do it in equivalence classes.
Two.
Like I can imagine a metric. Well, I can kind of imagine the distance between metrics, but
so
with equivalence classes.
If you want to do it in a good way, you can ask questions like, "What are the infinitesimal modifications of this structure?" Okay. So this structure gives you a complex structure. You know, coordinate patches and complex transformations between coordinate patches. You could ask yourself, how do I change this structure? Well, I change the coordinate transformations a little bit.
Okay.
Right? But the change in the coordinate transformation must be self-consistent, right? Because in triple intersections, the coordinate transformations must match. What you get is essentially a cohomology problem. You have, again, infinite space of infinitesimal deformations and some infinite space of constraints that these deformations must satisfy. You can work it out and convince yourself that there is a finite dimensional set of infinitesimal deformations. So you can convince yourself that near each choice of metric, there will be a certain neighborhood of nearby inequivalent metrics. And then again, you keep moving and you describe a manifold of possible metrics. This manifold of possible metrics is again a complex manifold. It's not completely obvious, but it's kind of reasonable because the coordinate transformations are, you know, holomorphic coordinates are what enters the transformations of Z, and the complex conjugate is what enters the transformation of Z bar. So you can convince yourself that there exists a complex manifold of inequivalent classes of metrics. There's an interesting, complicated complex manifold. And it's not compact. It has sort of asymptotic regions. And I'm trying to describe to do these asymptotic regions. In one asymptotic region, the surface looks like this. The metric on the surface looks like this. And there is a very long tube of radius 1 whose length is arbitrarily large. The larger the length, the more you move along this asymptotic direction in the space of metrics. And this length is completely analogous to a Swinger parameter in quantum field theory. So in this, when you do the integral over the whole space, the integral in this region will give you physics which is completely analogous to a quantum field theory process of this sort, the Swinger parameter L. But because this asymptotic region sort of enters the main manifold when L is of order the string length, we should put. Okay, so the analogy with quantum field theory breaks down when the string propagates for distances shorter, for times shorter than the typical time that is set by the tension of the string. Okay. There are three more asymptotic regions. In this region, the worksheet will look like this. In this region, it will look like a U-channel, which I despair to be able to draw properly. Whatever. I think you get what I want to say. Okay.
So it seems like you won't get a higher dimensional moduli space unless you have like a higher genus. Is that true?
That's true. The higher the genus, the higher the number of punctures, the bigger the moduli space. The dimension of the moduli space. If I'm not mistaken, is 3g plus n minus 3. This is not as mysterious as it looks like. So here, for example, the moduli are how long is this tube and how much am I twisting it. This is what the moduli space looks like, a line times a circle. More generally, for a complicated Riemann surface, for every internal tube, you can ask how long it is and how twisted, very roughly. But this will give you the correct counting of dimensions, because the number of internal tubes is precisely this.
And so why would adding another puncture not just give you like another like asymptotic tube in the moduli space? Like it seems like all that does is let you make lag on your surface.
Suppose you have five punctures now.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you can ask how long and twisted is this tube and how long and twisted is this tube. So now you have a two-dimensional complex manifold and you have asymptotic regions which look like are plus times f plus times two circles. But again, these asymptotic regions can be given a quantum field theory meaning in terms of diagrams like this. So inside the string, the space you're going to integrate, you're going to find essentially locations that describe quantum field theory physics, which has long enough Schwinger parameters. You never find a physics which has in quantum field theory which have short Schwinger parameters. For example, if you smash two strings together, like here, you will never find a situation where they where there is a lot of momentum transfer between them. There's sort of when you scatter two point-like objects, if they manage to hit each other close, they will scatter off a completely random directions. That's how Rutherford found that there were nuclei in atoms by shooting alpha particles and hitting the nuclei. But strings are fluffy. They don't have this hard structure, this hard core. So when you throw strings at each other, they pass through each other very easily. So already at tree level, this sort of cuts down the way amplitudes can grow as the energy grows. At loop level, it eliminates UV divergences. So for example, if you look at your simplest UV loop diagram, which would be something like a one-loop tadpole, again, the modular space of these, of complex structures on these, is one-dimensional. It has a long region which corresponds schematically to this quantum field theory process. But this tube is long, but it cuts off smoothly before this tube manages to get too short. So the UV the regions of integration which give you UV divergences are completely missing. Okay. So this is pretty much all I'll ever be able to say in these lectures about the complex space of complex structures on Riemann surfaces. from now on, we're going to be very local on the worksheet for a while. OK, so let me ignore this side completely and erase a bit. So if I understand correctly, you guys have done some scalar fields on the Riemann surface, right? In QFT, in the last QFT course. And presumably you've learned some OPE technology and things like that. So I'm not going to use it. I do as much as I can using good old free field theory. And then hopefully you'll see nice formula which can be also recovered with more high power conformal field theory technology. So what was supposed to be the objective of this lecture, and we'll go into next lecture clearly, is the study of a free boson with action which on flat space would look just like this. Let me use complex coordinates. Let me use complex coordinates, right? Well, not really. Let me just remain pedestrian. And just one scalar field. In particular, I would like to study the scalar field on a cylinder. Because my first objective will be to derive the string spectrum. Before I even start computing these complicated amplitudes, I need to figure out what to put as initial states and final states. Right. In order to do that, I need to give you the quantization of a free string, not interacting, just a tube in space-time. And in order to do that, I need to understand the scalar fields on a tube. Now, as I was mentioning, as a complex manifold, the tube can be taken to be just a flat tube. So I can have some coordinate sigma, which is periodic, and tau. So tau goes like this, is a Euclidean time, and sigma goes around. At the beginning of this lecture, I'll keep this length, which is the radius of the cylinder. Clearly, I can get rid of it with a conformal transformation, which is changing the side of the cylinder, but it's useful to keep track of it. If you want to, so I write everything in Euclidean signature. If you want to compare with Minkowski's signature, just remember that tau is defined as IT. I will also use a complex coordinate, which is tau minus I sigma. It's almost the same as the one I used there. I just multiplied by I for convenience. Now, if I have, suppose I want to study a scalar field on this geometry in Hamiltonian formalism. The way you do it is you first decompose the field into Fourier modes in space, and then each Fourier mode is essentially going to be an harmonic oscillator or a quantum mechanical mode. So if you decompose it in Fourier modes on a circle and you add a classical time dependence, you get something like this. Classically, this will be a solution of the equation of motion. Quantum mechanically, the modes, the coefficients, this expansion become quantum mechanical operators, which have the following commutation relations. And of course, okay. So let me try to explain a bit better. So x is the center of mass of the string. P is the overall momentum of the string. X and p behave like position and momentum of particle. These other operators, A and A bars, behave like harmonic oscillator creation and destruction operators, an infinite tower of harmonic oscillators, which essentially add or remove vibrations on the string. You can check, if you want to check that this is correct, I invite you to verify that if you do equal time commutators between the position, between the field and its conjugate momentum, this gives something like 2i over L sum over n of e to the I n over L sigma minus sigma prime, which is 4 pi I delta of sigma minus sigma prime. So see, the correct way to get here would have been to go backwards. You should say, OK, I want my field. This is the conjugate momentum to my field. I want the field and the conjugate momentum to have canonical commutation relations at coinciding points. Then you Fourier transform this expression, and you get to the result for the Fourier modes. You probably did something like this when you study a free scalar in QFT. So some of these modes raise the energy, some of these modes lower the energy. In these conventions, these modes raise the energy, and these ones lower the energy. You can convince yourself of the validity of these conventions by looking at the time dependence in Lorentzian time and see which of these modes have positive energy and which have negative energy. So now we can describe this, the Hilbert space. So first of all, we need to deal with this position of momentum. So there are going to be a bunch of states which are denoted as P, which have the property that they are annihilated by all modes that lower the energy. And there are momentum eigenvalues for P. Okay. I'm sorry for. I hate putting hats, but you can guess where the hats go. Given these states, which are delta function normalizable states for the, which essentially represent a string, which is, represent mode of the scalar field, where the scalar field is not oscillating, but the center of mass, the zero mode of the scalar field is just moving at constant speed. Then on top, out of these states, you can create an infinite tower of other states by acting the oscillators that raise the energy. And so on and so forth. Okay. So this is the Hilbert space of a free scalar, massless free scalar, on a cylinder. I mean, where space is a circle. You can compute inner products between any of these operators and their ket and their corresponding bras, just by using commutation relations. For example, suppose I take the state PA1 and I want to compute the inner product with the state A minus 1 B prime. What I can do is to use commutation relation between A1 and A minus 1. If I bring A1 here, it will kill B prime, and I'm left with just, again, delta of P minus P prime. I mean, I'm left with, I can write it as P A minus 1 A1 P prime plus P commutator of the two. And then this is just P P prime. And so on and so forth. So this gives you the space and the inner product. This kind of structure is often called the Verma module, where you have some vector which is killed by all states, all operators that raise the energy, and has some property under the zero modes. And then you build out of it an infinite tower of vectors, of other vectors, by raising operators. By operators that raise the energy. Now, this massless free boson theory has a lot of symmetries. The most obvious symmetry is that you can shift the boson by a constant, and that will not change the action. the corresponding current, every symmetry comes with the current, the corresponding current is just the derivative of x. It has two components in compass coordinates. It looks like that. Let me write them out explicitly. An important observation is that the holomorphic current is holomorphic. The holomorphic component of the current is actually holomorphic. The component in the direction of the holomorphic coordinate is actually holomorphic. And then, so the, okay, I want to say, current conservation usually would be a statement of this sort. For a generic current, this will be current conservation. But here something stronger happens. The two pieces of these equations are independently zero. What's more, it's obviously also true that if I put any function of s in here, this still vanishes. So I can define infinitely many new currents on top of the basic one. Essentially, the reason this happens is that you can rewrite the action this way. And then it should become kind of obvious that if you shift x by an holomorphic function, the action would not change up to some total derivatives. So instead of this, there is actually an infinite dimensional space of symmetries where x is shifted by an holomorphic function and then an anti-holomorphic function. Okay. Now, because of this formula, it's actually convenient to define a zero equal to a zero bar equal to p. This helps with the simplify notation so that the modes of the current are just ans. Now, what I want to do before the end of the class is to compute the energy of these states. So I already told you that these modes shift the energy so that the energy of these states will be greater than the energy of this state by some specific amount, but I haven't told you the energy of this state, for these states. I would like to compute the energy of these states. Now, usually at this stage, some unpleasantness happens in the sense that the typical presentation would be that there is an infinite tau of harmonic oscillators with frequency n. So the ground state of these harmonic oscillators will have an energy n over 2. And we need to add up all those energies. So the correct the energy will be something like sum of over n on over 2. And then people pull out from a hat a zeta function regularization or something like that to claim that this is the same as minus 1 over 24 or something like that. I don't like that. So I would like to show you a good way to compute the energy and explain actually why is there a good way to compute the energy. So how do you compute the energy in quantum field theory? See, for a generic quantum mechanical system, the notion of energy is a little bit ambiguous, meaning you can always shift the energy. But if you're doing quantum field theory, you need to be a bit more careful, because you want the energy to come from the energy momentum tensor. And you want the energy momentum tensor to have certain properties, for example, to be conserved. And you want to use definitions which are local. The strongest and most important property of quantum field theory is locality. You don't want to ruin the property in your definitions. Your definition of the stress tensor here should not depend on what's going on there. The definition of the stress tensor cannot depend on the global structure of the manifold. It might depend on your metric here, the derivatives of the metric here, but not the metric over there. These are very important constraints. Now, classically, the stress tensor can just be defined as the variation of the action with respect to the metric. So you can get a stress tensor for the free scalar theory starting from that action over there and doing the variation with respect to the metric. In general, this definition, if the theory is diffeomorphism invariant, the stress tensor is always conserved. If the theory is Weyl invariant, the stress tensor is also traceless. Both statements just follow from the definition. Because if you change the action, if you look at the change of the action under a change of the metric, which is a diffeomorphism, the action should not change. So, and if you change the metric by just an overall scale, if you change the metric proportional to delta AB, to the original metric, the action should not change. And both statements imply almost directly this. If your theory has a Weyl anomaly, this should not be true, but it should be almost true. So this should be true classically, and there should be some quantum mechanical subtlety. We will see in a few lectures that they are not in the Weyl anomaly tells you that the trace of the stress tensor is actually proportional to the curvature of your manifold. There are some factors of 24 or something, doesn't matter. But clearly, this is not going to be important for us because we are on a flat space. This would become important in other situations, but for now, we can ignore it. We will still encounter the Weyl anomaly, but not in this manifest in the phase way. So if you write a symmetric traceless tensor in complex coordinates, it has two non-zero components, TSS and TS bar S bar, while TS S bar is the trace and vanishes. TSS is classically minus 1/2 dSx dSx. Quantum mechanical, this definition is a bit troublesome because I'm bringing together two operators which have a singularity. You actually would say they have a non-trivial OPE. so what the singularity can be determined easily by the equations of motion. Essentially, when ds x and ds approaches ds x prime, the divergence there is a divergent part that looks like this. So a reasonable way to deal with this sort of divergences is to use point splitting, meaning you define your stress tensor as a limit . Is this a reasonable definition? It's pretty reasonable. This eliminates the divergence, so this would be finite. And furthermore, it's a purely local prescription. I don't have to tell you anything about the manifold far away in order to give you this definition. Do you think I can have a couple minutes?
Sorry?
When do you start?
In 10 minutes. I would like to write slightly beforehand.
Okay, give me. I guess we can do this next time. Well, I just want to say one thing. So if you are on R2 or C, this definition is the same as normal order. That's because the two-point function of dx of s, dx of s prime on C is literally minus 1 over s minus s prime squared. So on C, you could have said that t is the normal order of dx dx. Because the normal order, by definition, is you subtract the vacuum expectation value. But this is not true here on the cylinder. We'll do this calculation explicitly in the next lecture. But the point I want to make is that on the cylinder, the two-point function of delta x is not this. On the cylinder, the two-point function of x can be computed. It's essentially something like e to the s minus e to the s over l minus e to the s prime over l squared e to the s over l plus s prime over l, I believe, something like that. Okay, we'll get to it. But this is the result of a calculation. You can just say, okay, I take my path integral on the cylinder, I compute this two-point function, and you get an answer. So that means that this definition is not the same as normal order. So this definition differs from normal order by the difference between these and this as s approaches s prime. So I invite you to compute this minus this in the limit as s approaches s prime. You will find this answer. So When you compute the energy of a state, especially a state which has no oscillators, the normal order will not give a contribution. There will be a contribution like p squared over 2 from the zero mode. Okay, I'll do this next time, sorry. But you get on top of that this minus 1 over 24 L squared. And if you want to understand why can't you just get rid of it by redefining the energy, the stress tensor? Well, you cannot redefine the stress tensor by something that depends on the size of your manifold. That's not local. That's why I had L. If you do just a number, I would say, okay, maybe something proportional to the. If you do something, if it was just a number, I could have said, okay, let me redefine the stress tensor by a constant, no big deal. It remains conserved, remains traceless. But I cannot redefine it by a function of space, of the global structure of space-time. So this has a physical meaning, it's Casimir energy on the cylinder. Okay, that's enough, I guess. We'll ask questions in the next lecture.